Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. You wake up on your own. I wonder where you are. And live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all. So why don't you smile?
Now, this is always a treat for me because I met our next guest, Dr. Thomas X. Hammes, in 1984 when I was the junior, I was the second lieutenant and assigned as the platoon commander for the 3rd Platoon of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And Captain Hammes at the time was, he was a cool guy who was a weapons company commander, and all lieutenants wanted to go to weapons company because Captain Hammes was the only captain that taught lieutenants anything other than do what the fuck I tell you to. And so he joins me today. He now hangs his hat at National Defense University, the Institute for National Strategic Studies. So, sir, first of all, thanks for coming back on All Marine Radio and doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. Also, good to catch up again, but you should probably not mention it was 40 years ago.
He had good lieutenants. A guy named Mike Lambiez was a mentor of mine, and a guy named Mike Primo was another mentor of mine. I was a junior lieutenant, but you were into military education, and not too many other guys were at that time, sir. And so you had a great reputation over there in weapons company.
You know, you always get better results if you work to educate people. You're trying to work yourself out of a job. The ideal situation is the outfit runs without you, because that's may well happen on the first day of the shoot.
But why did nobody? But nobody did it. I mean, even the PME we did. I remember the first time I went to a reading PME, which was the Regimental XO of the 5th Marine Regiment, Marvin Hopgood at the time. He did a PME on reading, and I was pretty well read. Guy in, you know, high school and college. I mean, I read a lot relative to my peers and certainly in the Marine Corps relative to my peers. And then he started talking about a book that I'd never even heard of called The Forgotten Soldier and said it was a great book. But that was the first thing I'd ever heard about, like, you have an obligation to educate yourself. And it wasn't, I mean, the Marine Corps at that time was still and you joined, you know, years before I did, but I mean, the Marine Corps was still a rough, tough place. You know, if you were 18, you could drink at the E Club, and they did. It was still, you know, it would be years before you got a double signed fitness report for DUI, and so education was not a big part of what we did.
No, it's kind of funny. I got warned against reading when I was at the basic school. When I took over a weapons company, I established a program where every Thursday afternoon was the lieutenants and I doing PME in my office, because you're in from the field. It's cleanup. That's NCO business. The officer shouldn't be involved. Staff NCOs will inspect, and then you'll take their inspection on Friday morning. So we had mandatory reading, mandatory wargaming, and discussions. And a little bit of a shock to the lieutenants. The staff NCOs were frankly terrified I was going to institute it for them, too.
Let me tell you, your lieutenants would come and talk to the rest of us about what you were doing. And we'd be like, what? Yeah. And then we're like, it was awesome. We read this book and he taught us about this. Right. And, you know, they would tell us all this crazy stuff. TX and I go back, geez, Louise, 40 years. That's a bit sobering. I wanted to have you on and talk about Michael Gordon wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal. And most Marines have been tracking the General Berger's planning guidance that the Marine Corps was going to take the Marine Corps in a different direction. And so, first of all, let me give you the floor and give us your thoughts on what Gordon wrote Marine Corps losing all tanks, losing most of its tubed artillery, bridging assets going away, reducing buys for a lot of aviation platforms as it seems to go all in on confronting China and becoming a littoral force. So your thoughts on Gordon's article and what the Commandant has proposed.
Well, there's a couple things happening here. It's kind of like it happened to us before World War II when we had the big argument whether we'd remain colonial infantry and focus on counterinsurgency or we'd become an amphibious force. And the Commandant came down on amphibious force, and for a couple of reasons. One, we had a new enemy, Japan, and that creates a unique theater. The Pacific theater is very, very different than anywhere else in the world. And two, technology was changing rapidly and making things possible that were not possible before this. So we've got the same situation today. The National Defense Strategy says we're focused on China and Russia. And the informal guidance from the Secretary of Defense and Secretary Mattis was, Navy Marine Corps, you focus on Asia. Army Air Force, you focus on Europe. Now, more and more, we're also focusing the Army and the Air Force on Asia because of the difficulty, the problem of it. Now, what the Commandant is recommending really makes good sense. I mean, the Asia is going to be primarily for us a fight about defending the first island chain. And when you read the National Defense Strategy, they talk about having a contact layer. That's forces that are out there working with the local forces, constantly out there building the relationships. There's a blunt layer, which are other forward deployed forces that are to hold off the Chinese or the Russians, depending which theater, until the surge forces, which come from elsewhere in the world, can get there. And finally, they started talking about a homeland layer, which is necessary. You know, for 70 years, we haven't even thought about defending the homeland. And now we've got to think about defending the homeland in a very, very serious way. So all those technologies are changing. Now, when you look at the specific technology, tube artillery is really kind of maxed out at about 70 kilometers. And that sounds impressive, but a University of Virginia professor in 2014 3D printed a drone in 28 hours, assembled it, used a cheap motor he bought online and a couple batteries, and used it to perform for navigation. And that would go out to 50 kilometers for $800, or in other words, about the price of a long-range artillery. Way less than the price of a long-range artillery round. The other thing is, if you use the cell phone visual on AI, it can actually be an active hunter. Now, since that time, batteries have improved massively. So that aircraft can now go 100 kilometers. Well, what the hell are you doing setting up an artillery piece which can be hunted actively by one of these cheap drones? Now, the other problem is, in 2014, it took 24 hours to print that drone. Since then, 3D printing has improved at least 100 times and is well on the way to 200, almost 1,000 is the goal. So even if it's only 100 times, then you take, I don't know if you know, UPS is seeing that 3D printing is going to knock long-range shipping out. So they're getting heavily into the 3D printing business, 3D manufacturing. So they've opened a number of plants around the world with 100 printers. So if you have 100 printers at today's speed, that would be 10,000 autonomous drones per day, each one costing less than that of an artillery round. Now, I'm sure the Pentagon can double or triple that cost, but that gives you an idea. How does tube artillery stay in this fight? The other problem is, the real problem out in Asia is the Marine Corps' job is going to be help to hold the first island chain. And part of that will be defeating amphibious forces, but it's best to defeat the amphibious forces while they're still well out at sea. So long-range cruise missiles, artillery is too late. They're much too close by then. So long-range missiles, which the Marine Corps is looking at, you've seen the experiments where we fired a Tomahawk land attack cruise missile out of a can. Well, the Tomahawk sea attack version goes 250 miles. So you want to have a weapon system which goes 250 miles, a weapon system goes 40 miles. And that's essentially where the Commandant's moving is. Armor isn't going to have a big role out there. It will still have a role in things like non-combatant evacuations, things like that. But in those cases, because of the huge weight of the main battle tank, for instance, when in Mogadishu, there were places we couldn't go because the bridges weren't 70-ton bridges. Right. So you're in this position where you've got this huge piece of gear that you can't take anywhere. So I think those are good choices. Now, I'm really glad to see him reduce the squadrons from 10 to 16 for a couple of reasons. First off, if we go to war with the F-35, when we reach max global production, the global production will be 17 per month. That'll be shared among, I think we're at 11 air forces, two navies, and one Marine Corps that are flying them now. What that would mean is it may not be your month to get an airplane or combat replacement. So if you take half of those airplanes and mothball them, at least you have combat replacements. The other problem is, frankly, they are so expensive to operate, we're having trouble getting the hours in for the pilots. So we have better to have a smaller group of well-trained pilots and squadrons than to have a larger group of half-trained people. And I think that's one of the directions he's going. Save money, create a combat reserve. The other fundamental problem with the F-35 is it is so short-legged, it's extremely vulnerable. Now, we claim the B will operate from remote airfields, et cetera. Never did that with the AV-8 Harrier. I mean, I know we were promised to do that, but we only did it for the VIPXs at Camp Lejeune and Camp Pendleton. We never really did it in a truly austere environment off a road. Is it doable? Possibly for something like the F-18, the F-16, the F-18, the Finns do that regularly off their highways. We used to do F-16s off highways in Korea. I don't know if they still do. So you've got this thing fixed to an airfield. The airfield can be found, and cruise missiles have a range of 1,000 to 1,500 miles. Relatively inexpensive drones, the Harpy, has a range of 600 miles. So from a mainland China, you can attack Kadena Air Force Base and the Marine Air Bases in Okinawa, Japan, with a cheap autonomous drone in swarms. So I think he's coming to the...
Now, will you explain autonomous drone to everybody?
Yeah, an autonomous drone is a drone that you launch and give it a mission, like fly to the vicinity of Kadena Airfield and look for these targets in priority. And they're hunting the targets in visual and infrared. The AI aboard will compare the visual signal with the infrared signal. And then there's also an electronic warfare component if you have that built in, which the Israelis do in their version. So they send them out to hunt anti-aircraft missile batteries, and they go out and they look and they, you know, they see a visual signal. They get first use, they get an electronic signal, and the radar turns on. Compare it to visual and thermal, and then they suicide into the target.
Once I launch it, do I control it, or does the artificial intelligence control it?
So fully autonomous.
So any jamming, anything, it's impervious to.
Well, once it becomes GPS independent, I don't know if that particular one is GPS independent because, of course, they keep that classified.
Right.
But GPS independent drones are coming. For instance, if you're Amazon and want to deliver by air, and they really, really want to deliver by air, you got to have some things. You got to have vertical takeoff and landing, so no airfields. You've got to be GPS independent so you can fly in the urban canyons. You know how often your car loses, you know, GPS lost recalculator or whatever.
Roger.
Then you've got to be electronically hardened because you're going to be flying near airfields. You're going to be flying near stray radiation. You've got to have pretty good range. You've got to be cheap. Well, let's face it, that sounds like a great weapon system. We have commercial drones now that can stay up for 30 hours. Well, actually, we've got a small airplane that an outfit made that can stay up for 5 days, fully autonomous. So when you have those kinds of systems that can stay up for days and outrange you, then why are you investing in it? In for the Marine Corps, the F-35B is a $115 million platform. Of course, it doesn't work yet. There's still 407 key deficiencies, 13 major deficiencies that we have not solved.
But that's
according to the DOD inspector.
That's for a different radio show, though, right? We'll get to that at some point. But so we...
The Commandant is recognizing the age of manned aviation is passing. The Kratos drone flies 2,000 miles, totally autonomous, vertical launch, vertical recovery, carries two small diameter bombs or two air-to-air missiles. You begin to put those out in large numbers, they're only $2 million a pop, which in aircraft hours is incredibly cheap.
Roger. Roger.
And no airfield, no pilot training, no mechanic training pipeline, no airfield, no golf courses, no old clubs. All those things go away. But the big deal is you get away from the airfield, so you're no longer vulnerable to preemption because you're short-legged and sitting on the ground.
So just so we can understand this better, you talked about Marine Corps defending the first island chain. I had an email a couple days ago from somebody that said, well, why are we defending the first island chain to begin with? You know, going east to west or west to east, you can drop down below Australia. Why are we defending the first island chain? Why don't we defend from behind the first island chain?
Well, and because it's so much easier to defend the first island chain. There are only 9 major exits to the first island chain. If you go back from the first island chain, then the Chinese fleet gets out. But more important, the trade, the defeat mechanism for China is not necessarily destroying the fleet, because they can rebuild much faster than we can. The key is to destroy their economy through a long-term blockade. You can blockade that at the 9 exits to the South China Sea.
Got it.
The other thing is, as they drive you farther back, you can fall back all the way. There are 3 straits through Indonesia, way down by where Indonesia, Australia line up with Singapore. Of course, there's the famous Malacca Strait. There's also Lombok and Sunda. Then you've got a small strait north of Australia, and of course, open ocean south of Australia. But south of Australia, it's only 500 or 600 miles between New Zealand and Australia. So based on those 2 locations, you can close that route. You can essentially seal off China from trading with the world.
And you've got to do that at the access points.
It's much easier to do that at choke points. The reason you said ambushes at choke points is because you know they're coming through there.
Roger. Okay, so could you unfold for us, if you would, and I won't ask you to go into causes, but whatever would cause a confrontation in the South China Sea, could you go over, because for those of you that don't know what TX does, I mean, one of the things he does is he does future warfare. And he's always been one of those guys who who looked at the future and you know, was talking about things that the rest of us kind of just sat there and listened to. So could you unfold for us the things that would happen after hostilities would be initiated, and just give us, because most people, right, and I've read a little bit, and I would be hesitant to do it, but I'm confident that you can. Could you just give us how this thing unfolds and why these things make sense?
Yeah, I wrote a strategy for fighting China called offshore control, and I titled it Strategy for an Unlikely Conflict. It is very unlikely that we would do this. But
okay, so
the stupidity of people in large groups.
Will you send that to me so I can include that in this post?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay, all right. Now, if you wouldn't mind, walk us through that.
Okay, so whatever triggers it, we've got our forward deployed forces. More and more, we're understanding those bases are incredibly vulnerable. Two Navy commanders did a study 3 years ago on what would happen if the Chinese decided to use their missiles to shut down U.S. bases in Japan as the opening volley of a war. And the answer is, all our runways are cratered, 200-plus aircraft are killed on the ground, ships are hit, all our headquarters are hit, all of our logistics facilities are hit, all of our piers are hit. So that's the opening 2 hours of the war, if you remain structured the way you are. That's why the commandant's so big on getting us out of that forward-deployed and vulnerable situation. Now, if China starts that, then our problem is we have to help defend Japan. We have a treaty with Japan. We assume the Japanese self-defense is in the fight. We're in it, too. So that can hold the northern shoulder. That holds the Straits of Korea, which is way out. Then also all the way down to Taiwan, the Japanese are working to hold. I don't know if you know, the Japanese Army actually had 5 regiments of anti-ship cruise missiles, which used to be stationed up north specifically to stop Russian amphibious invading forces. They've now been re-equipped with better missiles and are moving to the south. So the idea would be they would kind of hold from Taiwan north with our assistance. Taiwan south gets a little more problematic. The Bashi Channel is the only deep water channel out of the South and East China Sea. Everything else is relatively shallow, and that's important because it makes mines much easier to use there. And it makes difficult for submarines to sneak up by those routes. So Bashi, if Taiwan is still in the fight or in the fight, she can provide help with this. More likely, the war, most people speculate, will be a war over Taiwan. So that creates a somewhat different situation. If the fight is over Taiwan, then the question is Japan in or not? If Japan is not in or refuses to use their bases, obviously this gets much harder. If Taiwan, or if the Philippines ban us from using their bases, it gets really, really hard. So that's going to be, for the Taiwan scenario, the alliance with Japan and the Philippines are vitally important. This is why Mr. Trump's handling of our alliance with Japan has been so worrisome. While Japan should be doing more financially for their share of defense, and he's got a valid point there, the problem is the way he's handling it is essentially berating, insulting. But most important, he has reduced our confidence that we will be there. And so if China's going after Taiwan and says the message to Japan, you stay out of this and don't let the Americans get in and you're okay, they got a real question here. Why would they fight with us if they're not sure that we'll fight for them? So that's a huge question on the Taiwan. And frankly, Taiwan is the most difficult scenario. How do we deal with that? Now, in a Taiwan scenario, that would be useful in that if the Marines can land on various islands. Or remember, if you develop these systems to be fired out of containers, there's no reason they can't be aboard ship. So you could use intercoastal freighters. You could use anything up to and including a Triple-E class 19,000 container ship. Put these containers on those ships and fight from there. So that's what these containers do, is give you intermodal capability. You can fight them from land. You can fight them from sea. And then it's a matter of getting enough fires in to prevent the landing in Taiwan. And then resupplying Taiwan. The key things are going to be food and fuel, food and energy and ammunition. And of course, this depends upon will Taiwan defend itself or not, and that's always the question. If it is not a Taiwan scenario, but the fight breaks out in the South China Sea because of some type of a collision or escalation between us doing a freedom of navigation operation and the Chinese trying to shut it down, we exchange fire, we exchange missiles, a couple ships are sunk on both sides, and neither side is willing to back down. And that creates a situation where the strategy works better in terms of holding the island chains. If you look at the ranges across most of those straits, it's very easy for missiles on land base to cover them. Also, we're beginning to see the development of self-deploying mines, which launch from the shore could then go out in the middle of the channel and wait. The other thing you can do is every Mark 80 series bomb drop from a standard airplane, if you put the right fuse on it, you can make a smart mine. And what a smart mine is a mine that has sensors. And it senses the acoustic signature of the target, a magnetic signature of the target, and a displacement signature of the target, so that it finds it as being within a certain class, and it checks and sees, is this a class I'm supposed to attack? The answer is yes, it launches the torpedo or detonates the mine. Now, bombs are fine down to 200 meters. They can just detonate to create the damage. So that allows us to very rapidly seed these minefields. So a combination of mines, missiles from the shore, and then aircraft. The Marine Corps currently, because we've got the F-35, is trying to figure out how to use it. You've got to figure out how to use it. So we're actually working on these rapid landing, refuel, rearm, and take off with the F-35 based on an LHA platform out at sea, coming in to refuel. We are at a FARP, and that's the way they hope to overcome some of the range complications, because the range of the Chinese F-26 missile can range Guam. So you got to be 2,000 miles away from the coast. Well, if you're 2,000 miles away and your fighter only flies 450 nautical miles, you got a real problem. And that's the thing we're trying to overcome. How do we manage that? So then that would be the fight key. The first thing you would do is get as many forces to the first island Japan as allies will allow and help defend. If China and Japan, then you fall back to the straits. With the straits, you don't have to have Indonesia in the fight. They're close enough to Australia and located in places where we could actually, from amphibious shipping conduct a blockade. Amphibious shipping would be Marines fast jumping down to take control of a ship that's refusing. Most ships in that situation will simply concede. Frankly, what really established the blockade is Lloyd's of London. His insurance rates go up so high, nobody will take the shipping contracts to China. It will be Chinese-owned ships that will. We can seize those fairly quickly, put them in for sale at prize court, and then the prize court takes those ships and sells them to somebody else that are not used by China anymore.
So the fight you're describing is not a close with fight. It is a hold, right?
And yes.
An isolate fight, and getting platforms in position to be able to enforce a blockade or the hold position, and then strangle their economy.
Yes, because the fact of the matter is that the history for the last 250 years says that wars between major powers are long, years to decades. Both sides will run out of ammunition fairly quickly. Probably within the first 6 months, our selected munitions will be gone. And then there will be a pause as we rearm. And we see this in a number of wars. The U.S. Civil War, the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, of course, is a classic example. World War II is also an example. The war lasts longer than you thought, as it almost always does, and then you got to gear up. The one change to that is the fact that both sides are nuclear armed. And the good news is, with the advent of nuclear weapons, where you have nuclear armed opponents facing each other, they tend to be very cautious. When you look at the India-Pakistan, they had three really major wars where they killed lots and lots of people. And then they had the Kargil crisis, where both are nuclear armed. And so the Pakistani big offensive action is to sneak 1,000 Rangers in up on the glacier, which nobody cares about, and prepare to fight. India then batches forces off the major border with Pakistan so that there won't be any confusion that we're starting a big fight, announces it open, they're going to kill those 1,000 guys, and then do it. Now, in the past, it probably would have thrown armored columns at each other. Same thing with the Russian-Chinese exchange in what's called the River War in 68, 69. Anyhow, they were had a conflict over the Amur River, fighting back and forth, almost a division-level contact. Both sides tamped it down because of the fear of nuclear weapons. Mao made it very pointed, and he did a test shot of a nuke out at his test range during the middle of the conflict, and everybody backed down. So that may be the best thing going for us.
All right, let me ask you some questions about the Marine Corps and how General Berger has kind of navigated all this. You talk about this like... and you said confrontation with China is least, I don't want to put words in your mouth. You said it was the least probable of conflicts. Is that fair?
The least likely, most dangerous.
Least likely, most dangerous. Talk to me then about, as far as I can tell, General Berger doesn't have an assurance relative to shipping platforms, as the Navy has not articulated what it's going to look like in 2035 or 2050, doesn't have an assurance from the Army that there's going to be some active duty tank, regiment that's going to be standing by, or tank brigade that's going to be standing by to support the Marine Corps, and the whole Marine Corps is going all in, not 3MEF. But the whole Marine Corps is going all in to this one most dangerous, least likely fight.
You say the whole Marine Corps, keep in mind that what we're doing is creating long-range weapon systems for the enemy we're going to fight. And we're keeping all but two of the infantry battalions or three of the infantry battalions. I would think we would have gone to half. If I were to charge, I would have cut the infantry battalions in half. I would have put half of them pretty much as configured, but changes as we learn. Which remain in the MUSOC business, so we still have the NEO capability. If we need a division-sized fight, we've got a division reinforced, that sort of thing. And then I would have put the other half into these type of firing elements, lighter elements that can go out and do this kind of work.
Okay, so that's what I want. I kind of want to talk about in terms of. I don't know if you would use the word hedge, but Mark Kansian did. Mark talked about the hedging, using the reserve, because if this is most dangerous, least probable, in the last 70 years, has been the last time that we thought we did anything close to a naval campaign, which was, if you were going to make the case for it, you would make the case Pusan, Incheon, and the Korean conflict. It's not the thing we tend to do most often. So the Marine Corps is now going to be tailored to a nuanced boutique fight, and not being the Swiss Army knife that has been for almost 100 years for the nation.
But it still is a Swiss Army knife, only it's a useful one. Your problem is you want to fight with a Swiss Army knife with a 6-inch blade. He wants to fight with a Swiss Army knife with a 20-foot blade.
And the 20-foot and the 20-foot blade is?
These missile batteries. Right now we're mounting them on MRS because that's what we've got. But we're doing experiments where we're firing them out of containers. Now, let's say in 10 years we get the container force type idea. 20-foot, 40-foot containers, smaller shipping containers for smaller missiles, the missiles that only go out 30 or 40 miles. The long-range missiles are 250 miles, 1,000 miles, 1,500 miles are in the big containers. So you are a major battery commander. You have four of these containers. Each container has four tubes, so four long-range missiles or 16 shorter-range missiles. You get ashore by commercial shipping, by aircraft, whatever, because there are standard shipping containers. Virtually anything that can move a shipping container out there now moves you. You get ashore and you have an American Express Black Card, a pile of dollars, and gold. And you buy four trucks to mount the containers on, and you buy other vehicles. Your troops are wearing, your uniform is something simple like a blue coverall, or like the World War II herringbone utilities, all green, all blue, whatever. You now completely blend with local society. Because you're using local trucks, you can use local fuel, you can buy local parts, you can do local mechanics. You buy your food locally, your water you get locally, you can treat it with those little camping devices. So now all I have to move in and out of country for you is ammunition and communication-specific equipment, and then if you're having your own drones for surveillance. And that's going to be more and more the case as we move drones down to the battery or company level, but drones which have a capability to stay up for 20 hours and do long-range surveillance. So that's a very different deployment problem. Because two of the biggest problems in the Pacific Coast are, number one is distance, and number two is liquid energy, moving fuel out. This is not new. In World War II, during the campaigns in the Solomon Islands, we initially did not deploy our battleships because they sucked too much fuel. We didn't have enough tankers to get the fuel down there. We're going to face that same sort of problem. We're not going to be able to get enough fuel forward to fuel the F-35. It's going to be a huge challenge. But if you have something like a Kratos drone, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am not.
The Air Force's XQ-58A, it's a drone that's about half the size of a Harrier, but it's vertical takeoff and landing, and it can fly 3,000 miles with 600 pounds. Fully autonomous. Now, that is your air power, and Kratos developed this thing on their own. Kratos can do it cheaply because they're a firm that since the 1950s has been making disposable airplanes. They fly target drones for the Navy and the Air Force. So they had to be cheap. They figured out how to do it. But as the AI got better and manufacturing things got better, they figured out they could make this thing. So they did. Now, one of the things they're experimenting with is, can I take the wings off and pack it in a 20-foot container? The other thing you've got to understand is that global surveillance is here for everybody. I don't know if you remember when we got the attacks on the U.S. airbase in Iraq.
Yes.
And the next day there was clear imagery in the newspaper. That was a commercial firm called Planet. Planet images the entire world every 24 hours. And they will sell those pictures to you with image interpreter. In the next 4 years, they plan to have that down to every 4 to 6 hours, and within 10 years, there will be constant global surveillance and infrared, visual, and synthetic aperture radar. So the idea you're going to go out there and hide is just crazy. What you have to do is one of two things. You have to get overhead cover or be under a building, like parked in a garage, something like that. Or you got to look like everybody else. You can play Where's Waldo. So if your weapons are in 20-foot containers being hauled by local trucks, supported by people in local vehicles that we purchased, it's going to be pretty hard to find you. and I can't remember the population of the Philippines. Is it 54 million or 100 million? I can't remember. But Japan's 110 million, lots of vehicles. The Philippines, lots of vehicles available. Indonesia, if they'll let us ashore. Australia, obviously. So the fact is you can do this on a very lean logistics chain if you think about it. If you stay with big, fat amphibious ships, you know, an LHA is 1,300 Marines neatly packaged for destruction.
Right. Right. I don't think anybody, I don't know anybody who hasn't come to that conclusion. And the largest question is, you know, how do you even get close, not to the fight, how do you even get close to a fight, right? If you're not already there, you're not going to get there.
Well, this is why the contact and blunt layers are so important. And that's part of force structure and force posture. Obviously, we're trying to change force structure.
Right.
If you change force structure and reduce the number of people, it also makes it easier to posture forward. You can pull back to Guam. You can pull back to the treaty islands out there if we make agreements with them. And we pursue the diplomatic channels. We are not doing that now. We have rejected Trans-Pacific Partnership, which really was a good deal for the United States. Not so much it would boost our economy much, but it would force everybody out there to meet standards before they export to the United States. That was there. Mr. Trump said no, and we'd still have no treaty for those areas out there. We also have the Federated Islands out there that we have an agreement for security with them, but we've been neglecting them for years. All administrations have neglected them for years. Now they're suddenly important. We need to be putting diplomats in there to talk with them, because the Chinese are.
Right.
Every time we go in and say we'd like to build an airfield here, the Chinese study the land and buy the land or take a long-term lease on the land between wherever the port is, wherever the airfield is, because they're going to build a casino. And they promise thousands of jobs. Now, that never really happens, but it does block our ability to develop. So they're playing with the full deck, and we're playing with just a military deck.
The perils of being democracy.
Well, yeah, I mean, and at times a particularly dim democracy.
Right, right.
So those are things that we are working on. And I think, again, this is where the Commandant sees that the Navy is beginning to see a fleet shift from big DDGs to much smaller frigate-type ships with missiles on them. One of the things we proposed to the Navy, and the Navy's taking a hard look, is called a missile merchant. If you have these missiles in canisters, then you can put them on merchant ships. Now, right now, the Naval Reserve really isn't particularly useful in the war.
Right.
In small wars like we're doing, they provided a lot of intel and a lot of people to go forward. But in a big war, there's not like a line of ships you're going to have to man. But if we shift to missile merchant, a 40,000-ton merchant ship is available today for $30 to $40 million. You add $85 million to make it a missile ship, and that's to buy the 50 missile tubes with the missiles in them and put them on the ship. You're $125 million. For the price of one quarter of that of a carrier and its air group, you could have 40 of these out there. That would give you 2,000 missiles. Instead of having a carrier range of 450 nautical miles to be extended to 700 if we get the 25, the new autonomous tanker they're building for the Navy. If we have that, then we get up to 700 nautical miles. But we have to spend an enormous number of resources protecting that carrier. The other thing is there's 5,000 Americans on the carrier, which makes it a great target.
Sure.
On a merchant ship, it's 15 to man the ship, 15 to man the weapons, 30 people. The other big thing that's crunching us downstream in our cost is personnel. So you can have 2,000 missiles with a total crew of 1,200, and no pilot pipeline, not the huge maintenance pipeline, not the specific training pipelines, or you can have 5,000 sailors out there, which is going to cost you less in the long run. From a Chinese point of view, I now have to target ships that can lurk up to 3,000 miles away, because remember, we can put Kratos drones on these ships too. So they can lurk 3,000 miles away from me and attack me. While the carrier has to come in close and is big and visible. Carriers, they will know where all of our carriers are all of the time from space.
Talk to me about
reality.
All right. Talk to me about, again, so everything you make sense, obviously. Everything you said obviously makes sense. But so the Marine Corps, again, the whole Swiss Army knife concept, this is – the Marine Corps becomes essentially I want to say one-trick pony. Explain how this fits around
–
explain how this,
of course, not changing.
Explain how this applies to other conflicts on the spectrum. Same.
Okay, so let's say we take the national defense strategy. China, Russia are the two primary. North Korea, Iran are the secondaries, and then violent extremist organizations.
Okay,
starting with Russia. The problem in Russia is there's no way to reinforce Russia fast enough to get there before they can cross the border and seize the Baltics. The Russians have implied, almost stated, that they will escalate to de-escalate, i.e. we will seize the Baltics. If you try to take them back, we will use nuclear weapons to stop you. Do we think the American people will do that? If the American people will, why would we be confident the Germans are? Polling in Germany shows that if Germany is attacked, less than 25% of the German population thinks it should defend itself. That's where Germany is. So even if we could get the Marine Corps to Europe, we have to get them all the way out to the Baltics. Now, that's a long rail and road trip. The problem is the rail and road in Eastern Europe is not sufficient to deal with that. They are rebuilding some of the railroads and they're improving the roads. But keep in mind that the precision weapons were designed specifically to kill bridges. That was their initial use. Remember the Dong Ha Bridge
right. In
Vietnam. So they can take out those bridges. So you can't get your forces there, even if they could get there, and even if the Allies decide to fight, et cetera. But if instead you have this containerized system, when you get your first indications, you can immediately ship or fly these things to Europe. And all they have to do is get somewhere in Europe to be within range of the fight. And then the Russians have to understand, when I start the fight, I'm going to eat hundreds of these long-range missiles. In addition, if we train the Baltic states, I wrote a paper on this called Melian's Revenge, How You Can Defend the Baltics Cheaply. If the Baltics, rather than buying conventional forces, take their reserves and train them to place IEDs, ammonium nitrate-based IEDs. Ammonium nitrate's great because everybody has hundreds of thousands of tons of fertilizer around, easy to make bombs out of, all you need is a detonator. So you train your reserves to do that. As soon as they see a threat, they mobilize and go out and put their IEDs in place. Now, these aren't necessarily small IEDs. You can do some with EFPs to destroy armor, but a 20-foot container holds 50,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate. You gross out before you cube out. If you detonate that, that's a 50,000-pound IED. Now, if you're the leader of an armored column and hit the first one, well, the first company doesn't have to worry about it because they no longer exist. The second company is looking at the smoking room and thinking about going on. So they get organized and go on. They go a few miles down the road to hit another one. Are you going to be able to get your third company to go?
It would be
20-foot containers because there's too many of them.
So what you're describing for me, no matter what theater that we would pick, is the same iteration of you got to get there. You got to get there. You got to get enough platforms in there. And once you do that, you can influence this. And this whole idea of close with the force, is that a thing of the past?
Yeah, pretty much. Now, the one place might be if we're doing another insurgency. Okay. Now, that would be phenomenally stupid. But again, one of the problems you see throughout American history, about every 30 years, we get involved in another large insurgency. And then we get our butts kicked and we say, okay, that wasn't a good idea. Or we struggle with it like we did with the American Indians and the Filipinos. And eventually we claim a win, but we learn that we don't want to do that again. And then what happens apparently is all the people who fought that way and lost age out. And we're Americans. So the new Americans all go, we can do this. We're Americans. We can solve anything. So we get involved in another one. The problem is, if you really study insurgency and you look at success through history, successful expeditionary counterinsurgency, and that's very important because expeditionary means you are not the government, you're helping another government. The only ones that have worked have been small, and advisory role. And if you find out that you cannot win with a small number of advisors and support, then get out, because that government cannot stand on its own. That's been the historical record. If we follow that rule, then it's a handful of Marine advisors, officers, staff NCOs, and some NCOs that can very rapidly, the initial surge would be poorly trained, but could go in. And then if we do it right, then we start training the subsequent people. And you don't go in for 6 months or 3 months. When you go forward as an advisor, it's a 2-year tour, sorry. Now, hopefully we'll be smart enough not to get involved in another counterinsurgency. But again, in 20 or 30 years, we probably will. Keep in mind, though, that for the first time, the insurgents can reach out and touch you, as the Yemenis demonstrated to the Saudis, and continually demonstrate to the Saudis with long-range missile and rocket attacks and more drone attacks.
Right.
If you see the imagery from the attack on the Saudi oil facility, mm-hmm. if you look at the 9 primary tanks that are in there, or 11, 9 of them have hit. All of the hits are almost in exactly the same position. They knew what they wanted to hit. They hit within a meter where they wanted to hit, and they got those incredible secondary explosions. Now, imagine if that was Bagram Airfield instead, and they were blowing up C-17s or 747s or cycling troops. Or suppose they say, you know what, the Americans defend their airfield pretty well, but all their forces flow into Kuwait, like when we were fighting ISIS. So we kill some commercial airliners at Kuwait. We tell the Kuwaitis, look, we don't want to do this, but we're going to kill Airbus 380s once a month until you tell the Americans they got to leave. So the Kuwaitis either tell us to leave, and then we have to decide, are we going to listen or not? Are we going to fight the Kuwaitis too while fighting these other guys? Or we convince the Kuwaitis we can defend Kuwait International. So they now go to the Saudis and they say, okay, until you lean on the Kuwaitis and make them stop, I'm going to blow up airliners at your big airfield. By the way, the Hajj, which you're responsible for, is a religious matter, incredibly important. I'm coming after that. So they can do threats now at long range with precision. The problem is we haven't made the adjustment yet that everybody has precision. In the 1980s, we shifted from mass to precision to defeat the Warsaw Pact. We don't know if it would have worked, but we got used to being the only people with precision weapons. What happens when everybody has precision? And not just precision, but precision in very large numbers. Remember the 10,000 drones a day from a single factory? What do you do in this great maneuvering tank close-in fight if overhead there's 10,000 active hunters? That's the battlefield the Commandant's trying to prepare us for, I think.
I have another question for you. So that answers why y'all in on one mission, and what you're telling me is that
it's not one mission. That's the battlefield around the
right,
world.
Right. That one mission is what you just said. The battlefield around the world. That's the new reality. Talk to me about other thing that has been a discussion point is so would you argue that this is not the normal evolution of war? This is the transformation of war to something that we don't we
yeah.
have. And I know that
this is a military revolution, not a. We kept talking about revolutions in military affairs, which tend to be technical and more limited.
Right.
Murray and who's the other author on that book? Murray and Knox wrote one called Military Revolution. From date to date, but they said there were 5 major military revolutions in history. And that's where society changes so totally, the way you do war changes totally. For instance, the revolution of ocean-going sail with large cannons mounted on deck completely changed naval warfare. The dominant fleets of the time had been galley fleets or short-range fleets, and now suddenly they can't even begin to stand up to these ships. The shift of naval warfare to iron, and then the shift of naval warfare to carrier-based aviation. So there are major revolutions in history. This is one of those, because the fourth industrial revolution is changing everything. I've written about this quite a bit.
Right.
I've got a new book called Deglobalization, International Security, that discusses how these broad-based changes across society are going to change industry. We're going to see deglobalization. We're going to see regional trade networks rather than global. And that's going to change what you value and who you're willing to fight for. And it's also changing the character war, because as you trade less with the world, you have less desire to go out. I mean, if you don't have scratched American, very hard to find an isolationist. The last election kind of proved that. When you add to that, that any time you attempt to go out there, it's going to be much bloodier. Because, again, how do you defend your airfields? If he can reach out with cheap drones 50 kilometers and they come out of regular white vans, how do we stop all the white vans in the Middle East from getting within 50 or 100 miles of a U.S. facility? How do you deal with swarms of drones? Okay, maybe you can deal with them around your base with laser, but how do you defend your mobile systems? And this is all an evolving problem that we got to figure out. This is the first step. And while there's big changes in the Marine Corps, it's not, again, look at what he's actually changed. A couple of infantry battalions. He got rid of a lot of cannon artillery, replaced it with much longer range, more capable precision weapons, or he plans to, and reduces the aviation wing, which is less and less useful and more expensive. Now, by the way, the damn thing still doesn't work. When you look at the Pentagon's test and evaluation branch, and the list of deficiencies it published on an aircraft is truly stunning. Why we're continuing to make them and buy them is purely a political decision.
Because we can make and buy the same capability unmanned for fractions.
Okay. Yeah, for fractions. Yeah, I just did a piece on this for Flight Global. What it says is if you look at the Kratos, the Air Force F-35A can go out to 700 miles. The Kratos can go twice that far, at least in combat radius. You want to return it. If you don't want to return it, if you want to make it expendable, it can go over four times that far. They're $2 million apiece. The F-35A is $88 million apiece. So you get 44 just to start with. But now you start subtracting the operating costs. Remember, you got to fly the F-35 every month in order to train the pilot, right?
Right.
So the F-35 program manager says that the F-35 will get 8,000 hours over the course of its lifetime. That's $44,000 an hour. Now they're trying to bring it down. They haven't had a lot of success prior to that. So I'm trying to look at some numbers here. You end up with that being like $372 million over the life of the airplane. So that's another 185 Kratos. So now you're over 200 Kratos. Now you start adding in the fact I don't have to train pilots anymore. So that's not just the pilots in the squadron. That's all the pilots in the pipeline. That's all the big bases that train pilots and all the personnel that train pilots. Maintainers, because it's a much simpler platform, you probably cut your maintainers by 2/3. So all those training schools go away. Your airfield and airfield operations people and base maintenance people, all those people go away. So really, you're probably getting 400 or 500 Kratos over the life of the aircraft for one F-35. Now, if I'm a opponent looking to fight in the United States, the F-35 is reusable. So is the Kratos. Now, the Kratos only carries 2 small diameter bombs, but the F-35 only carries 4. They're claiming they're getting 8 with a new redesign. So let's give them 8. So that's 4 Kratos can carry the same payload as one F-35, but they carry 2.5 times as far for 1/45 of the cost. And oh, by the way, many of the targets Kratos can hit, the F-35 can't get to because the legs aren't long enough. And tankers don't work because they can't operate that far forward in an air defense environment. And we're seeing a revolution, a military revolution, general military revolution, where manned aviation coming off long airfields is no longer a viable component, nor are big ships at sea going to be viable. Now, this will take place over a period of the next 10 to 15 years, with our procurement system probably more like 20. But the key thing is there, if you look at the historical pattern on it, how does new technology get adopted? What usually happens is somebody looks at it and says, okay, that's pretty neat. Maybe it would be useful. And this goes, let's take a look at the pike was a weapon which dominated infantry combat for almost 200 years, the Tercio, the Spanish battalion. Then some people saw these muskets and they said, well, that would be useful, but they're really slow firing, so the pikemen will run them down and kill them. And somebody said, well, suppose we keep them outside the battalion, as the other side's coming, they fire once and they run like hell. Would that be useful? I said, yeah, that's pretty useful. They can be helper. Then as the musket improves and it can now stand in ranks, they begin to integrate it into the battalion. Pretty soon half the battalion is muskets and half is pikes. So this is where it's a full partner. Then we develop a socket bayonet, which is a bayonet you can clamp on the end of the rifle and still fire the rifle or the musket. And that's when the pike goes away. So the pattern is helper, then partner, then replacement. And you look at carrier aviation, did the same thing. Airplanes, the first job was to look over the horizon and find the enemy fleet, because the battleships couldn't find the enemy fleet. Second job then became spot for the follow shot, because battleships can actually shoot over the visual horizon. So you're doing that. As airplanes get better, by the mid-1930s, so 15 years after you're starting to use these at sea much, they were running a carrier striking group and a battleship striking group. You don't call them that, but that's essentially what they are. And in 1935, the carrier group sneaks on a Sunday morning and runs a strike on the battleship group tied up pier side at Pearl Harbor and would have sunk all the battleships at Pearl Harbor, yet the referees disallowed it. Okay, that's interesting. The Japanese then demonstrated it in 41. By 1942, they've gone from being the partner in the battleship carrier striking group into a full replacement. After the Battle of Midway, nobody thinks the battleship is a capital ship anymore. So helper, partner, replacement. If you look at what drones and cruise missiles have been doing, in the first Gulf War, they were helpers in that they helped suppress enemy air defenses so the manned aircraft could go downtown. By second Gulf War, they're full partners. A lot of targets are being just passed over to cruise missiles. As we move on, we're seeing they're replacing manned aircraft strikes on heavily defended areas. We don't send missiles or don't send manned aircraft anymore. We send missiles. Drones, if we want long-term surveillance of a area, we're sending drones. So we're in that same pattern, and we're going to see that pattern for artillery being replaced by rockets and then missiles. So the key is, where are we in that pattern, and how do we make that transition? And that's what the commander is doing. He's taking the first step there.
The so I would submit to you that unless you understand the revolution, that it's ongoing, that whatever the commandant's doing is not going to make sense to you.
Absolutely. Unless you understand warfare is fundamentally changing, and that's one of the problems. A lot of Marines go, well, goddamn, that's not the way we did it when I was in. Well, no, but you remember when we were in, we still had World War II. Well, no, by the time you got there, we got rid of the World War II helmets.
No, I wore mine. I had my 45. I had that and the helmet. Right.
Old. Yeah, and the mortars in my first weapons platoon had been made in 1942. The hack I had when I first came in was one of those World War II packs. We were still using shelter hats. So for me to say I understand what's going on now, even in infantry combat, I mean, we've got these combat optical gun sights now. We've got all kinds of systems that are assisting the infantrymen to be more accurate, put out more fire. We've got the switchblade, of course. We shipped 4,000 switchblades, which is the little above size or two above size 60 mortar. The little drone pops out. It's only good for 10 minutes, but they put an explosive in the nose. So if you see something, it's up for surveillance, and then as long as you're up there, you might as well kill something. Approach. Well, we've had that now for 10 years. Should we be pushing that? Should we not be poking our noses? I mean, we still have a system where the way a Marine finds out what's around the corner is he sticks his face around the corner. That's why Commandant Neller was putting a small drone in every squad and experimenting, is there a different way to do this, was a great idea.
Right.
And we're going to see more and more of that.
So if you understand, that there's a revolution coming, that you'll quickly conclude that the close with mission is now, I don't want to say irrelevant, but it is now is no longer a point of emphasis, that you are not going to have to close with in order to destroy somebody.
Because some will still have to close with. I mean, that inevitably you can't do away with that. And that's why the commandant is keeping infantry battalions, and we're keeping most close-in weapon systems. I mean, we still have the weapon systems that can do that. What we're trying to do is extend the range. You don't want to be in a close-in fight. I mean, there's always a pride in the Marine Corps, we close with, locate, close with, and destroy.
Right.
I'd like to locate and destroy him. Let's skip that whole close pace. Because getting close enough for him to shoot at me is comfortable. Why should I allow that? Even worse is letting them shoot at me and I can't reach them, which is where we are with China right now in the Far East. with their missile, and they created this rocket force. I don't know if you saw the reorganization of the People's Liberation Army. They took rockets out and made them a separate force. So they've got a four-star general. The sole job is to figure out how to make rockets and missiles go farther, be deadlier, and be harder to hit. You don't have any equivalent to that, other than now the Commandant's starting to push that line.
Talk to me about, and in order to wind this up, let me ask you to give us some reading suggestions. If people want to understand, I wrote down Murray Knox and The Dynamics of Military Revolution, 1300 to 2050. Yeah. McGregor Knox and Williamson Murray, obviously from Ohio State University. You can get it for your Kindle for $29, and the hardcover is $40.49 right there. You can get it cheaper if you want to buy it used, just so you know. But
There's also Millett and Murray. That's Colonel Millett, U.S. Marine Corps Reserve, Dr. Millett at Ohio State.
Right.
Wrote a book years ago called Innovation in the Interwar Period, and this looks at six countries between World War I and World War II and what worked for them on innovation. Now, that tells you the process you have to go through, as does military revolutions, kind of the process you go through. It doesn't tell you what's actually happening. I'll send you, like I said, my book covers that. It's an academic press, so it's too expensive. It's $39 for the paperback. But if you buy that on Amazon, you can get it at that price. That will describe for you both the technology revolution that's happening, and then how that applies in warfare.
And give us the title of that, sir.
Deglobalization and International Security.
Deglobalization.
And also and International Security.
Got it.
I will send you a couple papers that I've written on this. One was 4 or 5 years ago now, The Revolution of the Small Start Many, describes how this technology is changing, and what's happening is there's emerged in a generation of small, smart, and cheap weapon systems. We're heavily invested in very few and exquisite weapon systems. So can your one F-35 defeat my 400 drones? Of course, you have to have an airfield big facility. I'm running around in containers. That's the problem. Oh, the other thing is I have twice the range you have. So that's the kind of the revolution I talk about there. You talked about the new strategy, or the strategy for fighting China. I wrote that in 2014. It's out of date now because of this revolution. The same strategic concepts are there, so I'll send you that. I've got a new one coming out in the next month or two from Atlantic Council that will update that using the new technology.
All right. What would you, in terms of when the last question, in terms of, as the Marine Corps goes down this, what's the greatest challenge in front of the Marine Corps as it goes down this road, you know, into this world of a revolution in warfare? What's the biggest challenge?
Internally, the problem is we have to genuinely grasp into the warfare. Now, we've been talking about that since you joined the battalion in 1980 or whatever. But we haven't really managed it. One of the reasons is the personnel system is still actively hostile, because a single damn and faint praise for support means you don't get promoted. Well, if you're going to do true maneuver warfare and turn your guys loose, you'll get some first-class screw-ups. And we had a couple in weapons company. The key is that the rest of them will do it so much better than you could that that'll protect you from the screw-ups if you've got a reasonable boss. And Gregson was a reasonable boss, the previous battalion commander, was also a reasonable boss, so I didn't have to worry about that. Later, I encountered people who, one mistake, and you were done. And so when you decided to operate the way you've been operating, you knew that was the risk. As long as we have that, we're not going to get, mathematically, you'll eliminate your risk takers. So internal to the Marine Corps, you'll be getting rid of that idea, the old idea, getting truly believing maneuver warfare, self-education, reaching out, trying to do things different. Outside the Marine Corps, the problem is going to be the political, military, industrial complex. The F-35 is one of our biggest expenses. It is produced in 380 some congressional districts or something. Yeah. That's intentional. It makes it bulletproof in Congress. Big ships, we have the same problem. The Navy came out and said they thought they wouldn't refuel the Harry S. Truman and just let it go out of service the next number more years. The senators from Virginia, Washington, and California, where the carriers are based, wanted to make sure that didn't happen because they don't want any reduction in the carrier fleet. That's jobs in their district. You have to keep in mind that for most Congress people, the prime function of the Pentagon is to move dollars to their district. They don't care how those dollars get there. They don't have a good concept of what's needed to fight. And so we're going to be fighting against that resistance. And within the Marine Corps, I mean, vested interests. Tube artillerymen aren't happy now. F-35 guys are not happy now. And you look back through the history of the Marine Corps, and very often it's the vested interests that make it hardest to change them.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the things, you know, when maneuver warfare, and you were a part of it, was argued all over the Marine Corps, does some of this get laid at the commandant's feet? Because this, from everything I could tell, this has been done in a relatively small group. And there hasn't been, I haven't seen, you know, him go long format and lay what you've laid out for me today. Because, you know, I always, it's kind of a joke, but it's sad because it's based in truth. The first part of my life, I never read a footnote. Then I discovered that it's all in the footnotes. And so without the footnotes, right, you can't understand it, right? You're walking around like a dumbass. And so to me, I think that's kind of what, when you hear, you know, the commandant's vision, and it's so radically different from, you know, as you said, this is not the most likely. It is the most dangerous course of action. Okay, we've made a living for the last 70 years since the Korean War of being a force in readiness, you know, to be able to fight across a range of military operations, yada, 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 yada. Yeah. And now everything that we see is, you know, that without the footnotes is and without, honestly, without the vision that says this is the situation that we're going to go into more and more, and your snapshot of Yemen, your snapshot of what the Iranians did to the Saudi oil facilities, those snapshots and saying, okay, this is now going to be the norm, but without those footnotes, and has a commandant held this too close and not showed this enough to socialize it, to allow the debate to begin, to allow the education to begin? Because that's what happened with the maneuver warfare thing. You could go anywhere without guys, you know, talking about it and without you being branded either an attritionist or a maneuverist.
Yeah, essentially, that's what's starting now. Remember, General Gray, when we went to maneuver warfare, kept it kind of under the covers for all his time as a division commander moving up, and then finally when he's commandant, he's free to throw it out and say, this is what we're going to do. There were a number of people pushing that at the colonel, lieutenant colonel, and some flag officer level.
Right.
So it's the same thing. Like you said, you've got to socialize. First, you've got to decide what you're going to do, because the worst thing to do would have been throw out a bunch of ideas. Then the planning group comes back and says, no, that's not what we're doing, so you throw out confusion. Now we've got a document out there, the planning document. Now we're starting the publicity thing. I mean, Michael Gordon got great access because the commandant's trying to sell his story.
Right.
So we're beginning to see this. There are a number of us writing on that. While I generally disagree with almost everything Heritage puts out, Dallas put out a good one. What the hell did he call that? A Heritage paper on the future of the Marine Corps. Laid out the arguments. I've been putting out some pieces in different places. So the argument is alive and well in the D.C. area. We're trying to socialize it in Congress because that's where you really got to win.
Right.
If you're going to make a change like this, Congress has got to say yes. And so there will be a socialization. You're part of that process. Marines are calling in going, what the hell is going on? Then you have the conversation.
Well, if you said they're saying what the hell is going on, you'd be cleaning that up quite a bit. When you said Dallas, did you mean Dakota Wood?
Dakota. Yeah. Dakota
right.
Wood.
Right.
Sorry about that.
Rebuilding America's
Mail. I apologize to Dakota because he has done a really good job of synthesizing that and putting it out.
Right. Right. And so interesting. All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about this topic that this conversation won't be complete without you injecting?
Well, again, I think the key thing that you talked about there at the end was the personnel system has to adjust. we're going to have to be an older, more mature Marine Corps. The idea of a sergeant squad leader is probably going to go by the wayside. We shouldn't have captain company commanders. If you're out there operating on, you should probably be a major. The rest of the world has understood this for a long time. It's only America and its sister captains. I commanded a company as a brand new captain, a week in grade as a captain. And then after I'd had 2 years in grade as a captain, and then again, a company which was converted to a battalion as a major. I was a much better company commander as a major than I was as a junior captain. So that experience needs to be there. Then the XO is a captain, and that allows to do more training. One of the problems with a very junior captain, the first time taking over a company, you haven't been an XO in a company, which is more and more the case. You can't teach your lieutenants because you don't know what the hell you're doing. You're learning as you're going along. So personnel process has to change. Less emphasis on majors on staffs, more emphasis on majors in companies, captains on staffs. And then, of course, the zero defects mentality has to go away, and we've got to change the promotion system, and I am nowhere near smart enough to figure that out.
Come on, don't lure me in like that. I know you are. You just have to turn two on it.
Well, I think one of the things I've pushed for years has been a 360-degree fitness report.
What does that mean?
Well, your boss writes a fitness report, a couple of your peers do, and three or four of your subordinates. And they're all rolled in and weighted. Now, the boss is weighted heavily. Maybe it's one-third, one-third, one. But you then see a pattern. If the guy's boss always loves him, but his troops think he's a... Oops, I shouldn't say that on the radio.
No, you can't. We're okay. This is internet. Okay. This is internet radio. We can line it up whenever we want to. There are no rules. We're in the open west.
But see, this would destroy the toxic leader. The cautious take no risk leader. The troops always know that, and the peers always know that, don't they? You can fool the boss, but you can't fool your peers, and you certainly can't fool your subordinates. Why aren't we asking them what they think of this guy or gal? That would be powerful. Tentatively, hesitantly try that a little bit with various things, but then, oh no, it doesn't really count for promotion. And people go, well, how can I possibly trust my career to this, you know, your lieutenant, this junior corporal who isn't that well rounded? Well, he's been in the Marine Corps longer than you have. You're going to trust him with 13 of your Marines 1,000 yards behind enemy lines, and you're not going to trust him in your career? What kind of weasel are you? So we need to go to that type of a process. Now, 360 reporting has been done in a lot of companies. Some have done it extraordinarily badly and destroyed companies. The interesting thing is we have Marines out there who are personnel managers in companies who have succeeded in doing that, Marine reservists or retired Marines or just former Marines. Pull them in. Have them help build it. Pull the reserves on active duty and say, you're going to rebuild this thing from. Now, that would be a way to get at this problem. Not a perfect solution, but it's got to be better than one guy sitting up on top. And even worse now, the guy who really is important is your reviewing officer. As a DLT commander in Okinawa, I saw my reviewing officer on one occasion when I had a fight with him. I was fighting to get one of my guys promoted, and he was saying no. That did not please him a great deal. That was the only time he saw me in my entire report. And yet that was the most important fish part of my career was that one. How does that make sense? And that's true for everybody. Your reviewing officer may never see you or see you. I mean, as a company, as a platoon commander, how often did the battalion commander see you in the field?
Oh, whenever he wants to, which is not very often. And the odds that when he comes to see my company that he winds up with around me, infinitesimally small. Well, I mean, if he came to see my company and I was a company CEO, I mean, I would hope I would see him.
Yeah, but he's not. How often does a regimental commander when you see out with a company commander? So you got to go two up. How often does a division commander see a battalion commander, or the MEF commander see the BLT commander at a MUSOC? Because that's the problem. The MEF commander is your reviewing officer.
Yeah, when you go two up, you don't see that guy.
Yeah,
except
so
at the
hell
at
is the right guy to make this choice.
Right.
We've got to do better than that. We keep saying people are our most important resource, and then we spend so much more intellectual energy on getting an F-35 through or that god-awful expeditionary fighting vehicle. It's such a disaster. And until we start spending that kind of effort on personnel and really figuring out how we do this, then I don't think you can succeed. We succeeded because the guys and gals we're bringing in Encore are just that damn good. And despite all the handicaps we're giving them, despite the rocks we put in their rucksack, they succeed. But against this type of enemy, against a new type of thinking enemy, we're going to have to do better than that. And it's really personnel issues.
Sir, first of all, I've taken up a bunch of your time today, and I hope you don't mind if in the future as this discussion, in my opinion, gets more heated, and it will. I mean, I think the biggest thing people will question is the speed of your revolution. Well, wait a minute. We're giving away our tanks, and we're giving away this. And I don't doubt that maybe someday, but, you know, if that revolution doesn't happen for another 20 years and we've marginalized ourselves in the short term and our, you know, I can hear the argument. Yeah. So I hope you don't mind if I bug you and drag you back on and we beat up some of these footnotes.
I'd be happy to. And I'd happy to do, if there's any way to do interaction with your listeners, I'm happy to do that too, because you're right. This is all part of socialization, part of understanding how fast this is happening. To give you an idea, 3D printing, when I first looked at it in 2014, I was really impressed that they were printing these little plastic things in about a day that were really intricate, and you couldn't make them with a machine. And what they're doing today, they took a turboprop engine on a commercial aircraft in Europe. It had 355 parts in the engine. They gave it to their 3D designers, GE did, and said redesign to use 3D manufacturing and then manufacturing. There are now 12 parts in that engine. Now, 3D printing's been around since the mid-1980s, but like almost all innovations, there's this exponential curve, exactly like the curves you see on these viruses we watched all the time. It's really long and flat, then it hits a curve, and then it goes vertical. And that's where we're in the vertical position on advanced manufacturing. So we've gone from doing cheap plastic to complete turboprop engines in 6 years. You don't have 20 years to wait around to do away with tanks. Because your tanks are too heavy, and I'm going to kill the fuel trucks. I'm not sending these little cheap drones after your tanks. I'm going to sell them to kill your fuel trucks. And in 8 hours, you've got a big chunk of metal sitting out there that's totally useless.
It should be an interesting discussion. Because,
okay, I look forward to it.
Well, no, because, you know, I mean, the maneuver warfare one, I mean, that discussion got heated, you know, in a hurry. I mean, it was swimming upstream, right, into an organization that had made a living and written its history with two up and one back. And I remember being told, I got told at the infantry officer course, I might be mistaken, that, hey, Lieutenant, what I want you to think, right, my pants will be around my ankles and I'll be waving my hands over my head. Until then, you do what I tell you to do. And when I got to the Fleet Marine Force, how do you succeed as an officer in the Marine Corps? You find out what your commanding officer wants and you give it to him. And that's the way it worked. And so it ought to be an interesting discussion. It ought to be an interesting discussion as this thing gets socialized. So, sir, first of all, thank you very much. I apologize for being late. And always a privilege to talk to you again, a fellow 1-5 alum, and certainly to pick your brain about the future of warfare and in particular about the path the Marine Corps has chosen. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, and keep out there, keep pushing. We need to have this discussion.
No, you know, sir, one of the great things about what I do now is I've always enjoyed articulate intellectual discourse, and I think Marines are starved for it. And so having you on and bringing you on here and having this discussion, you know, in detail as much as we can in about an hour and 15 minutes, I think goes a long way with challenging them to say, okay, you've got to consider this stuff now. And then, as you said before, they're incredible human beings, and they're a lot smarter than a lot of people give them credit for. And so it's always interesting to hear what they say and what they do. So, again, thank you. That is Thomas X. Hammes, formerly of the United States Marine Corps. And, again, I met him in 1984 when I was a second lieutenant. He was a company commander of weapons companies, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And he's written extensively on future strategic concepts, on humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, and insurgency and irregular warfare. And so when he lays it out for you, right, I mean, what TX does is, Dr. Hamas, if you will, what he does is he changes the fundamental assumptions of the argument. And then he takes you down that road and say, hey, if you understand the future, and this is the future, then this is what you're going to get. So always interesting. Always interesting. More Ball Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.